You know that people will let you down, but computers aren't supposed to. We expect people to be unfair. People are fallible and prone to faults. Yet we expect technology to be impartial. Maybe it doesn't always work the way it's supposed to, but we tend to believe that inanimate objects are largely unbiased. That is, until we're locked out of accessing a building, product, or event that most people can access without difficulty. When the cycle of exclusion is in effect, the resulting designs are far from fair. Not all exclusive designs are negative. They simply reflect a series of choices made by people who have the power to set the rules of a given design. Clothing made to fit certain body shapes. Special edition products created to generate interest in a new business. An invitation-only birthday for an inner circle of friends. Sometimes creating limited access can have positive benefits. The problem comes when there's a mismatch between the stated purpose of a design and the reality of who can use it. When a solution is meant to serve any member of society and then doesn't, the effect of exclusion can be negative. The experience can feel like rejection from society itself, especially in the shared physical and digital spaces where we learn, work, share, heal, advocate, create, and communicate. There is a risk that exclusion will become more prevalent as technology moves into every area of our lives because interactions that were once human to human are now facilitated by machines. Every human interaction that includes technology gains a wild card. Who will it reject and who will it accept? Exclusion habits. What leads to cycles of exclusion and why are they more prevalent than inclusion? Every day, design teams make incorrect assumptions about people. They might presume that someone who's blind doesn't use a camera, or that a person who's deaf doesn't use a music streaming service. Is it malicious intent? Not likely. Let's consider the first element of the cycle, why we make. As we set out to solve a problem, let's imagine that most people have the best intentions to create a beneficial solution. Their goal might be to solve a known issue for their existing customers. This is often in competition with other goals, like meeting a due date, looking good in front of someone in an authority position, or earning a reward for driving new business growth. In the crucible of competing goals, even the best intentions can get lost in the shuffle. There can be little time to think. We might want to pursue our best intentions for inclusion, but there's a constant pressure to keep growing and moving quickly, like a carousel on fast forward. In these moments, assumptions become a necessary shorthand. And then something much more powerful takes the lead. Habit. Paley refers to this as the habit of exclusion. Without an implicit understanding of how exclusion works, our default habits we formed in our early childhood, can dominate, creating a cycle of exclusion. An exclusion habit is the belief that whoever starts the game also sets the rules of the game. We think we don't have the power to change a game, so we abdicate our accountability. We keep repeating the same behaviors over and over. In short and simple games, it might be easy to call on the one who's responsible for changing the rules to make it more inclusive. Over time, games get more complex, leaders change, and we can forget who authored the original rules. In some organizations, the cultural behaviors were set a long time ago, and the founders of that culture are long gone. Or we believe it's someone else's job to rewrite the rules, maybe the leaders in our business or community. We also forget that those rules were initially written by human beings and can be rewritten. Those of us who are now playing the game have a responsibility to adapt it as needed. If we don't, we are accountable when someone's left out, not some leader from the distant past. We can respect the intent of the game, but also adapt the rules to make it more inclusive. An architect might create a building with a grand staircase leading to its front entrance on the basis of tradition or aesthetics. Meanwhile, people who use wheelchairs might be searching for back alley entrances and convoluted hallways to access the building. When making choices in the design of a solution, we might think, "Those are just the rules. I didn't make them up." It's easy to defer responsibility by claiming this is just how the world worked when we arrived. This is why it's important to distinguish why we make solutions, especially when we work on behalf of companies and organizations. While anyone can start to shift their personal reasons for creating solutions, inclusion often needs to be made part of an organization's culture by people in the most senior leadership roles. If inclusion isn't explicitly part of that leadership, exclusion will be the default. Building new habits. Exclusion habits can be hard to break, but like any habit, they can be changed over time with new practices to challenge our mindsets and behaviors. When we say that we're committed to inclusion, it's like declaring that we'll learn a new language. We start the next day full of enthusiasm and optimism, but become quickly aware of our huge gap in expertise. Learning a new language can take planning, training, and determination. But above all, it means engaging with people who are native to the new language you want to learn. To gain fluency, you will need to change aspects of your routine and adjust some of the elements of your life to support your new goal. You might even relocate to a community where your new language is spoken every day. The same is true for building skills for inclusion. These skills can be learned from people who interact with unwelcoming designs every day of their lives. They often have an intimate understanding of all the angles to consider. These are the designers, engineers, and leaders who have the greatest power to disrupt the cycle of exclusion. Learning from these experts, we will identify the top exclusion habits for each element of the cycle, and we will highlight ways to shift the cycle toward inclusive design. Takeaways. Why it's time to kick the habit. Mismatched designs contribute to the societal invisibility of certain groups, like people with disabilities. When a designed object rejects a person, it can feel like social rejection and approximate physical pain. Exclusion habits stem from a belief that we can't change aspects of society that were originally set into motion by someone other than ourselves. 4. Inclusive designers. Building the skills to recognize and resolve mismatches. John R. Porter's bedroom would make any die-hard gamer feel right at home. Among the personal computers, beyond the Run Lola Run movie poster, across from the MakerBot busily extruding plastic threads into an unidentifiable widget, is a large, black pegboard. The kind of board my grandfather used for hanging hammers and wrenches in his garage. Mounted on the pegboard, like hunting trophies, are dozens of video game controllers dating back decades. Among them is the 1977 nostalgia-inducing Atari Video Computer System controller with its joystick and single red button. Hundreds of millions of people use this kind of controller to play the legendary game Pong. Next in line is the 1985 iconic block-shaped Nintendo Entertainment System controller with two buttons and a T-shaped directional pad that players use to maneuver through Super Mario Bros., one of the most popular video games of all time. Symbiotically, video games and their controllers grew more complex in the 1990s as home video games grew in popularity. Porter's pegboard features the contoured dual grips of the 1994 Sony PlayStation gamepad and a few hefty Microsoft Xbox controllers released since 2001, adorned with buttons, sticks, triggers, and a directional pad. Moving along what Porter calls his wall of exclusion, it's easy to notice how the controllers grew larger, heavier, and more complex over time. But one thing unites them all. They all require two hands to play. These controllers are gateways to vast virtual worlds. In these worlds, players achieve new skills, explore complex landscapes, and connect with each other. For many years, Porter admired these games from a distance, excluded from playing them by the shape of the controllers. We first met when Porter was a design intern at Microsoft. He was working on his PhD while teaching at the University of Washington's Human-Centered Design and Engineering program. Better than most people, Porter can tell you exactly how to create an inclusive solution. Technology is very tightly integrated with everything he does. He uses a wheelchair to get around and assistive technology to extend his own abilities. These technologies help Porter bridge the mismatched designs that he encounters when using everyday objects and spaces. In a world where most technology is designed to be used with a keyboard, mouse, or touchscreen, Porter depends primarily on speech recognition. He uses his voice to interact with computers through a software program called Dragon, created by Nuance Communications, Incorporated. Dragon listens and follows his commands. By talking naturally to his computers, Porter can create lesson plans, compose written communications, and participate in online gaming. He's active in a community of gamers with disabilities that share elaborate techniques for how to hack together alternate ways to play their favorite games. Sometimes this is a hardware hack, like a Switch controller that can be modified to work through head movement. And sometimes it's a software hack, like programming a sequence of game actions into one simple command. For example, just by saying, "Prepare for attack," a program can coordinate multiple characters to aim in the same direction at once, rather than having to align each one of them manually. Porter ties his experience with gaming to everyday life, making insightful connections between play and inclusion. Here are some excerpts from a conversation with Porter to guide our exploration of the second element of the cycle of exclusion: who makes it? Why did you build a wall of exclusion? I keep these here to remind me of all the assumptions that we as designers make about people. The design of these products clearly signals that gaming is for some people and not for others. A game controller says, "This is for you," or "This is not for you." This is true for everything we design. What happens when designers make assumptions about people? All of these games are based on a broad assumption that you'll be using your fingers and your hands to interact. And for me, that is almost entirely moot. I have some physical mobility that I can use to move my wheelchair, but everything I do in the digital realm is mediated through other avenues of interaction, primarily speech. Whenever I'm using technology, I use speech to control it, even though it was never designed to work for speech. It's not just that the game isn't optimized for my abilities. It was made without ever even considering the possibility that someone would need to interact with it in the ways that I do. That places the onus on me to figure out all these workarounds. For gamers with disabilities, we have to spend as much time figuring out how to play a game as we do actually playing. How does a designer make something inclusive? Games that only allow a user to play in one way, that have a prescriptive notion of who a player is, those tend to be the ones that are the least accessible. But games that allow more freedom and flexibility tend to be a lot more inclusive. I often like to point out World of Warcraft as one of the really great inclusive games. There are players who don't have the motor ability to interact fast enough to engage in combat, but I know people with disabilities who have played this game for years. They have all of their crafting skills maxed out because, for them, the game isn't about doing quests. The game is economics. The game is building a leatherworking empire and making gear that people can buy from them. And I don't know if anyone at Blizzard Entertainment would say that they envisioned that as a viable playstyle. But nevertheless, they built an inclusive system. What's the role of gaming in your life? I still remember the day that my Uncle Mike came over to give me Final Fantasy VII as a 12th birthday present. It was my favorite game, despite the fact that I'd never played it. I'd watched him play it, but was never able to join in. I was able to play games until I lost the ability to use game controllers around the age of 10. For me, gaming was becoming a spectator sport. My uncle once spent an entire afternoon trying to tape little pieces of wood onto his controller to make it work for me. When the efforts were unsuccessful, I told him not to worry about it. Final Fantasy just wasn't for me. "Sure it is," he reassured me as he picked up the modified controller. "We just need to stop this thing from getting in the way." I don't just play. I work to figure out how to play. It's figuring out how to participate in societal moments, which is a burden sometimes. I think of it as a metagame that I play in all areas of my life. It's a puzzle to be solved and shared. How is gaming shifting from exclusion to inclusion? there's a natural inclination to use yourself as a shortcut to make assumptions about the people that you're designing for. And I think that's especially rampant in the world of game design. Historically, the industry has been incredibly homogeneous. Games have been created by people who feel like they are never going to be different than they are in that moment. Many of them feel like they are the only users who really need to be considered. And that's changing, which is good. I don't think it's a coincidence that the increasing diversity amongst game designers is happening concurrently with the release of more inclusive games. I think those two things go together. Porter also points out that for decades, games and consoles were made exclusively by large companies with massive technology requirements that took years to release. Only an elite group of designers worked for these companies. Today, a growing community of gamers with disabilities and organizations like Able Gamers are pushing the creative boundaries of how people design and access games. Years of patience and sheer resourcefulness are opening up the benefits of gaming to a much wider audience. Also, with multiple open ways to make and publish games, a more diverse group of people are creating more diverse content for people to play. A new generation of inclusive-minded designers and enthusiasts is gradually transforming the gaming industry. Inclusive designers can emerge from traditional design disciplines. They can also come from unexpected backgrounds. It's important to define the specific design skills that contribute to inclusion so that more people can become practitioners. This is also why we must reimagine what it means to be a designer. Deciding who designs. The power of shifting who makes has had a similar effect in industries beyond gaming. More designers are focused on how to adapt objects to make them work for a diversity of people. Open source tools enable more people to contribute to the design of everything from education to artificial intelligence. The cycle of exclusion shifts toward inclusion when more people can openly participate as designers. Anyone who has ever solved a problem is, in a certain sense, a designer. The only real difference comes in how much ownership you take over the identity of yourself as a designer. You might be a designer if you say that it's not enough to design for yourself and you want to design experiences for other people too. Consider the rigid ways that companies hire new employees. Many companies require candidates to complete an online application, an often tedious process that requires specific language competencies, access to the internet, and an ability to focus on detailed information for long periods of time. In the tech industry, a common approach to interviews is for a candidate to meet sequentially with multiple people in a face-to-face verbal interview. The questions are designed to assess how likely a person would be successful in the role they're applying for. As the day wears on, a candidate needs to have a high degree of physical and mental stamina to endure the process. In the end, the hiring process itself can send a clear signal that the job is for you or not for you. Yet, how many aspects of this process have a direct correlation to how well a person will really perform in a role over a multi-year career? With this in mind, let's consider three skills of successful inclusive designers. 1. Identify ability biases and mismatched interactions between people and world. 2. Create a diversity of ways to participate in an experience. 3. Design for interdependence and bring complementary skills together. Ability biases and mismatched interactions. Many organizations create solutions for thousands, if not millions, of people. Creating solutions at such a large scale means hundreds, maybe thousands, of designers and engineers are working together on various aspects of a solution. When all those team members bring their own biases to the process, it can be challenging to make a solution that works well for all the people it is intended for. In fact, it can seem absolutely impossible. The underlying challenge is human diversity. A common starting point for teams is to focus on increasing the demographic diversity of their team members. Representation of diversity is important. However, changing representation doesn't necessarily change culture. Culture change can be hard and takes time. If we increase diversity of a team, but don't also evolve the cultural elements that surround that team, It can place an extra burden on people to navigate the metagame of exclusion in their own work environment while also delivering successful solutions for the business. Ability is one of the few categories that transcends all other types of human diversity. We are all born and gain abilities as we grow. We lose those abilities as we age. As we move through life, our abilities change as a result of illness or injury. They even change when we move from one environment to the next. Our vision changes when we move from a dark movie theater into the bright sunlight. Our ability to hear a conversation changes from a quiet elevator to a crowded party. Human ability, in its many physical, cognitive, and societal forms, is a building block of design. A person's capabilities and limitations are always a factor in how successfully they interact with a solution. Furthermore, something extraordinary happens when we make human ability our first consideration. Everyone can relate to the idea that abilities are limited and ever-changing. It rings true regardless of nationality, professional training, unconscious biases, or worldview. It enables a common ground from which to start designing inclusive solutions. Of all the biases that designers bring to their work, ability biases are the sneakiest. An ability bias is a tendency to solve problems while using our own abilities as a baseline. When we do so, our solutions end up working well for people with similar abilities and circumstances, but can exclude a much wider group of people. Even the most empathetic designer will typically create a solution that she herself can see, hear, and touch. She'll use her own logic and preferred ways of communicating. Her eyesight acuity, hand dexterity, and language fluency will influence the way she creates solutions. Even the design tools that she uses to create a solution will reinforce her ability biases. Ability biases aren't inherently bad. They aren't necessarily something to eliminate. In fact, they can be strengths. Once a designer develops the skill to recognize their own ability biases, they can start to recognize the ability biases in other people as well. Porter's ability biases as a gamer are speech commanding, strategic coordination, and navigating problems through experimentation. But he doesn't simply design solutions that work for his own abilities. As an inclusive designer, he creates solutions that consider a range of abilities beyond his own, so that a wider audience can successfully use his designs. How do we extend beyond our own ability biases? No degree of wearing a blindfold will ever be equivalent to the experience of being blind. The blindfold can actually give designers a false sense of empathy, especially if they attempt to simulate disabilities without ever meeting or working alongside people with disabilities. If we're designing a solution that will be used by millions of people and our ability biases are inevitable, where do we start? To unlock this conundrum, I invite you to consider diversity through the lens of human interactions. That is, our interactions with each other and the world around us. In 2001, the World Health Organization published their World Report on Disability, referring to disability as a complex phenomenon reflecting the interaction between the features of a person's body and the features of the society in which they live. This is also known as the social definition of disability. These points of interaction are where mismatches occur. For designers, this can open a new mindset. It's a profound shift from thinking about disability as a personal health condition outside the range of normal. When we consider disability as a mismatched interaction, it underscores the responsibilities of the designer. Every choice we make either increases or decreases the mismatches between people and the world around them. A well-loved example of mismatched design that led to innovation is OXO Tools. Betsy Farber was having difficulty using kitchen utensils due to arthritis in her hands. The thin metal handles of objects like a potato peeler were difficult and painful to hold. Her husband, Sam Farber, worked with her to develop a new grip design. The new design was rounded to fill the hand and was made of flexible rubber that could shape to the unique grip of each user. The Farbers created their first set of 15 OXO Good Grips kitchen tools in 1990. The design was dramatically more comfortable for Betsy, but also worked well for anyone who had difficulty holding kitchen utensils due to wet or slippery hands. a diversity of ways to participate. Mismatched interactions also arise when we create solutions with only one way to participate. In our gaming example, this can be a controller that requires two thumbs, a high degree of manual dexterity, or a high degree of hand strength. It's also about the range of roles that players can act out in a game: warrior, merchant, coach, athlete, etc. Inclusive designers create a multitude of ways for people to participate in and contribute to an experience. To better understand this, let's discuss several definitions of inclusive design. Although the term has been around for decades, it was largely an academic practice until recently. When I first learned about inclusive design, very few companies were applying it to their work in a repeatable way. At Microsoft, we sought out mentors from universities. Most importantly, Yuta Treviranis and her team at Ontario College of Art and Design. Treviranis founded the Inclusive Design Research Center in 1993 to focus on ways that digital technology can improve societal inclusion. She has a clear approach to selecting each new cohort of designers. We need designers who have experienced barriers. What we want to produce is not a uniform set of individuals with specific competencies, but a group of individuals that can work as a team, that each can contribute a diverse perspective. Another mentor in our early days was the inclusive design leader that I referenced at the opening of this book, Susan Goltzman. Her definition of inclusive design will always be my favorite. Inclusive design doesn't mean you're designing one thing for all people. You're designing a diversity of ways to participate so that everyone has a sense of belonging. Goltzman led her design projects with what she called the INGs. She would sit and observe how many different human activities were happening in a park. Goltzman would ask, "What ING is most important to this environment?" Maybe it was running, digging, swinging, climbing, or sleeping. Whatever the ING, the next question was always, how many ways can human beings engage in that activity? Imagine a playground full of only one kind of swing, a swing that requires you to be a certain height with two arms and two legs. The only people who will come to play are people who match this design because the design welcomes them and no one else. And yet there are many different ways you can design an experience of swinging. You can adjust the shape and size of the seat. You can keep a person stationary and swing the environment around them. Participation doesn't require a particular design, but a particular design can prohibit participation. The same phenomenon applies to technology. If writing stories required a keyboard, computer screen, and fluency in English, the only stories we'd read would be from people who match these requirements. Each feature created by designers determines who can interact with an environment and who is left out. Building on Treviranis's and Goltzman's guidance, here's a working definition of inclusive design that we developed at Microsoft after applying it with thousands of engineers, designers, and business leaders. Inclusive design, a methodology that enables and draws on the full range of human diversity. Most importantly, this means including and learning from people with a range of perspectives. We also found it helpful to distinguish inclusive design from related concepts, like accessibility and universal design. Here's a quick primer that guided our work. Accessibility. 1. The qualities that make an experience open to all. 2. A professional discipline aimed at achieving 1. An important distinction is that accessibility is an attribute, while inclusive design is a method. While practicing inclusive design should make a product more accessible, it's not a process for meeting all accessibility standards. Ideally, accessibility and inclusive design work together to make experiences that are not only compliant with standards, but truly usable and open to all. Most accessibility criteria grew out of policies and laws that were designed to ensure barrier-free access for specific disability communities. Wheelchair access and architecture only became prominent across the United States after the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed by Congress in 1990. The 1998 Section 508 amendment to the United States Workforce Rehabilitation Act of 1973 mandated that all electronic and information technology be accessible to people with disabilities. The United Nations created a Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities in 2006 as an international agreement to focus on the full societal integration of people with disabilities. Inclusive design should always start with a solid understanding of accessibility fundamentals. Accessibility criteria are the foundation of integrity for any inclusive solution. Another concept that is closely related to inclusive design is universal design. Universal design, the design of an environment so that it might be accessed and used in the widest possible range of situations without the need for adaptation. Universal design was born out of the built environment. It is rooted in architecture and environmental design. It emphasizes the end solution, most often one that is physically fixed. The principles of universal design are focused on attributes of the end result, such as simple and intuitive use and perceptible information. In contrast, inclusive design was born out of digital technologies in the 1970s and 80s, like captioning for people who are deaf and audio-recorded books for blind communities. Inclusive design is now growing into adulthood alongside the internet. In some areas of the world, the term inclusive design is used interchangeably with the term universal design. I prefer to make a distinction between them in two ways. First, universal design is strongest at describing the qualities of a final design. It is exceptionally good at describing the nature of physical objects. Inclusive design, conversely, focuses on how a designer arrived at that design. Did their process include the contributions of excluded communities? The second distinction, initially coined by Trey Varonis, universal design is one size fits all. Inclusive design is one size fits one. We'll explore this further in Chapter 7 with a technique called a persona spectrum. Inclusive design might not lead to universal designs. Universal designs might not involve the participation of excluded communities. Accessible solutions aren't always designed to consider human diversity or emotional qualities like beauty or dignity. They simply need to provide access. Inclusive design, accessibility, and universal design are important for different reasons and have different strengths. Designers should be familiar with all three. An inclusive designer is someone, arguably anyone, who recognizes and remedies mismatched interactions between people and their world. They seek out the expertise of people who navigate exclusionary designs. The expertise of excluded communities gives insight into a diversity of ways to participate in an experience. Making accessibility accessible. If you're not already familiar with the basics of accessibility for your field, you're not alone. The good news is you don't need to become an expert in solving everything. You just need to know enough to know when you need to bring in a true expert. You need to know how to recognize accessibility issues and how to design solutions that work well with the assistive technologies that people rely on. Here are four unique challenges that people commonly face when they're new to accessibility. Lack of educational resources. Accessibility fundamentals are rarely taught in school or by employers. The companies that are leading in inclusion are creating curricula to help engineers and designers learn the basics. There's a community of accessibility specialists who are also producing great educational content. Much of this information is available online in open formats for free. This will give a general introduction to what you need to know. Complex legal verbiage. Accessibility focuses on legal standards. The language of these standards can be intimidating, unless you're a lawyer. Some companies hire external agencies to conduct conformance testing for accessibility standards. Accessibility criteria can also be inexact. That is, they might not give specific details on how to create an accessible solution or measure whether it's successful. Finding the signal in the noise. It can take significant investment and time to build a custom set of criteria that apply to your business or solution. You can also create your own checklist of top exclusion issues to avoid and test for throughout your design process. In general, we need better ways to validate that inclusive solutions are working as intended in the real world. A highly manual process. After decades of being underprioritized, the tools for checking accessibility haven't kept pace with the advances in technology. As a result, a lot of product testing is conducted line by line by human beings. This seems to be changing quickly as more people are building the requirements of accessibility right into development tools. Ideally, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to produce an inaccessible product. Interdependence and complementary skills. In cultures that overemphasize independence, it's less common to design solutions with interdependence in mind. In the United States, there's a deep attachment to the idea of a rugged, lone pioneer, or astronaut, or entrepreneur, or cowboy, venturing out into the great unknown to make their way in the world. When they succeed, they're hailed as self-made heroes of strength, ingenuity, and resourcefulness. These stories of independence rarely reflect the truth of our lives, which are full of dependencies. People with disabilities often depend on human assistance and assistive objects. The skills of these assistants are vital to closing the gaps between the implements of daily life and a person's abilities. And all people are increasingly dependent on technology to engage with the world. Interdependence is about matching complementary skills and mutual contributions. Thinking back to Porter's example of online gaming, vast worlds are inherently more inclusive when they have a diversity of ways to contribute to the game. These games, like any society, don't thrive solely on the skills of hunters and warriors. The society is a system of interdependent skills, an economy that includes many different types of novices and masters. When designing a solution, it's easy to treat people as individual entities. Even in the design of shared products, especially in social media, many solutions assume that groups of people behave merely as collections of independent individuals. Each person is treated as a separate entity, blasting bits of information out to other individual people and waiting to count the number of likes that they receive in return. An inclusive designer thinks in terms of interdependent systems. They study human relationships. They observe the ways that people bring their skills together to complement each other. Inclusive designers seek out a diversity of ways that people build collective accomplishments. As inclusive designers, interdependence challenges us to think in broader ways about systems of contribution. It prompts us to ask what human activities, which INGs, are most important to the things that we design. Designing for interdependence changes who can contribute to a society, what they contribute, and how they make that contribution. We are all designers. The traditional design professions are rapidly changing, especially in areas of technology where the required skills change so quickly that many universities are struggling to maintain a relevant curriculum. Much of today's design work isn't limited to people with the word design in their professional titles. Among those evolving design roles, there is a new category of skills in inclusive design. This is critical in many areas of society, but urgently needed in technology design. As technology permeates intimate areas of our lives, design becomes an intimate act. People invite products into their homes. They share their secrets with personal devices. They use digital technology to facilitate moments of sharing, celebration, and mourning. Each of these technologies is built by people who are making assumptions based on their own biases. For better or worse, these choices can also determine who gets to participate in society. People who've experienced great degrees of exclusion can translate that expertise to the solutions that they create. Their experience can shape every other aspect of the cycle of exclusion. But this strength isn't the result of being considered different from other designers by some facet of demographic diversity. Their expertise stems from being familiar with exclusion and what makes it a universal human experience. This knowledge can make it easier to recognize the exclusion that many more people face, bringing a greater appreciation of what is gained when a design process is truly open to diverse perspectives. This is how inclusive designers learn to flex their ideas and combine their strengths. Takeaways: building the skills to recognize and resolve mismatches. Exclusion habits: creating solutions with only one fixed way to participate. Creating solutions using our own abilities as a baseline, known as ability biases. Treating accessibility and inclusion as an afterthought or only meeting the minimum legal criteria. How to shift toward inclusion. Consider diversity in terms of human interactions and how people change over time. Identify ability biases and mismatched interactions that are related to your solution. Create a diversity of ways to participate in an experience. Design for interdependence and bring complementary skills together. Build a basic literacy in accessibility and grow a depth of expertise in the specific accessibility criteria that are relevant to your solutions. Adopt a more flexible definition of a designer. Open up your processes and invite contributions from people with relevant but non-traditional skills. 5. With and for. How generations of exclusion are made and broken. The next time you're at a street corner, waiting to cross, take a moment to notice the details of its design. Note the orientation of the buildings, the intensity of sounds, or crowds of people. Who designed that street corner? How are their choices influencing your ability to move or to interact with other people? Of the many professionals who contribute to the design of our world, architects have to achieve some of the most stringent criteria before being allowed to practice. The degree of training and testing required to become a licensed architect is incredibly high. After completing the necessary education, the credentialing process requires years of experience and thousands of dollars to complete. The whole process can take 12 and a half years, on average. With public safety at stake, this makes sense. In contrast to the industry of video games, where open source platforms are making it easier for anyone to become a game designer, it's hard to imagine the same thing happening in architecture. This makes the role of an architect a useful lens to examine how we make. There's a greater context beyond the individual designer that influences exclusion and inclusion. In addition to business criteria and technical requirements, a design is shaped by the history of events that precede it. This means that shifting a cycle of exclusion toward inclusion isn't simply a matter of designing an object in new ways. We also need to disrupt the momentum of how things have been done for a long, long time. A city of design. The whirring of power saws and high-pitched beeping of construction trucks fill the downtown streets of Detroit. The skeletons of new high-rises stand tall alongside historic buildings with some of the most beautiful examples of Art Deco in the country. In 2015, Detroit became the first U.S. city to be named a UNESCO City of Design. The distinction is an acknowledgement of the city's rich architectural heritage and a long list of influential local architects and designers who defined American modern design. While Detroit is well known as the heart of the American automotive industry, its artistic strengths are equally impressive. In my first visit, Tiffany Brown guided me through the city. An architectural designer and native Detroiter, Brown is exceptionally talented at building connections with people. We wove in and out of parks, restaurants, and cathedral-like lobbies of office buildings. She moved at a breakneck pace, sharing vivid details about each location. The nuances of each design and the names of the architects were all new to me. Brown describes the features of the architecture through the stories of the people who gathered there to celebrate, mourn, create, and build. The best restaurants for birthday parties. The murals in a quiet alleyway that transforms into a concert venue on weekends. She has a keen sense of how spaces bring people together and how design creates a sense of belonging. A growing number of architects, like Brown, believe the people who inhabit a space should contribute directly to its design. Her firsthand experience with how design can fail communities motivated her to pursue architecture. She understands how designing for, not with, people can lead to exclusion. We pass through a small triangular park with the words Paradise Valley engraved on the ground. Brown points out vacant storefronts that once formed a thriving economic center for hundreds of Black business owners. People gathered in these streets to hear jazz legends like Dizzy Gillespie, Ella Fitzgerald, Duke Ellington, and Louis Armstrong. This park marks the north end of what used to be Black Bottom, named for its rich marsh topsoil, one of the few neighborhoods where African Americans were allowed to live in the 1920s through the 1950s. In the early 1900s, Detroit was a beacon of economic opportunity, especially for African Americans. The city's population exploded from less than 500,000 in 1910 to over 1.5 million people in 1930. Many of these new residents were African American migrants from the South. Neighborhoods like Black Bottom were places whose inhabitants knew and looked out for each other. Residents intermingled with national heroes like boxer Joe Louis, and there was a palpable belief in the community that anyone could be great. Over the course of the decline of the local automotive industry, the nationwide recession in 2008, and the city declaring bankruptcy in 2013, more than 1 million people left Detroit, likely never to return. Urban planning and architecture played a role in this decline. Black Bottom was demolished in the early 1960s to make way for the Chrysler Freeway and a new mixed-income neighborhood designed by Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. The thriving center of Detroit's African-American community was destroyed, and most Black Bottom residents moved to public housing projects across the city. Brown drives us to the edge of what once was the Brewster Douglas housing projects. The pace of construction is dramatically softer. The pounding of a hammer starts and stops from inside a brick shell of a partially demolished home. Across the street is a common sight in Detroit, a large lot, empty and overgrown, surrounded by a wire fence with a bright white sign reading, "Road Closed." The Brewster Homes, which later grew to become Brewster Douglas, was the first federally funded housing project in the United States. It was opened with a ceremony attended by Eleanor Roosevelt in 1935. The Brewster Homes promised to be family-oriented residences for working-class African Americans who at the time had limited housing options. These first homes were largely funded by private benefactors. For several decades, these homes were well-managed and maintained by the federal government. The promise of family-oriented housing started to change when the Frederick Douglass Towers were added to the Brewster Homes in 1951. The stark, cramped design of these 20-story block-shaped towers was a far cry from the original townhomes. This style was typical of the rising modernist movement in architecture that borrowed heavily from a vision set by Swiss-French architect Charles-Édouard Jeanneret-Gry, known also as Le Corbusier. His concepts of towers in the park was just one example of his mathematically precise approach to architecture, based on béton brut, French for raw concrete. Le Corbusier's approach to architecture made a strong impression on Robert Moses, a man known as the master builder of New York City in the mid-20th century. He was also demonstrably racist, as detailed in Robert Caro's Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, The Power Broker. Moses built extensive parks, beaches, roadways, tunnels, and bridges that transformed New York City during the decades of his tenure as an appointed public official. And he did so with a keen focus on excluding communities that he deemed unworthy to enjoy them. In one infamous example, he lowered the height of overpasses to prevent the passage of public buses, the primary mode of transit for low-income and African-American residents. One of the practices that Moses embraced in the footsteps of Le Corbusier was to demolish what he deemed blighted areas, displacing over 500,000 residents in pursuit of his vision. He would raze entire neighborhoods to the ground, creating a blank slate for new housing projects and expressways. This top-down approach to planning architecture became a beacon of modern urban development and was replicated in cities across the United States. Through the 1950s and 1960s, Congress allocated fewer and fewer funds to building and maintaining high-quality public housing. As they did, the design quality declined. High-rise towers, often with one elevator to service scores of families, became a design standard for public housing projects across the United States. With reduced funding, restrictive policies, and neglected maintenance. The buildings of Brewster Douglas fell into disrepair in the late 20th century. Once home to nearly 10,000 Detroiters, they were marked for demolition with the promise of rebuilding people's lives on a foundation of entrepreneurship and training for new jobs. The last residents were moved out in 2008. Federally funded Section 8 housing vouchers were the only way that many people could afford to live outside of the development, which meant moving into private landlord-owned homes in disparate areas of the city. Many residents protested. Some refused to leave their homes and were forcibly removed. This story isn't unique to Brewster Douglas. The pattern of destroying Black and low-income neighborhoods to make way for urban renewal projects has been repeated across Detroit for decades. As the city's design evolved, it gained new features that excluded people from each other and from economic opportunities. A racial distribution map underscores this point. Today, the population of Detroit is roughly 700,000, and over 80% are African American. The surrounding metropolitan and suburban areas are predominantly Caucasian. The spaces between communities are marked by clear physical boundaries that correspond to major roadways. The final stages of the Brewster Douglas demolition were supervised by Brown in 2014, while she was working for the architecture firm Hamilton Anderson Associates. During the project, she met with former residents who arrived to watch as buildings were being deconstructed. They shared family stories, remembered loved ones lost, and recalled the places where lifelong friendships took root. People gathered to recognize this place that shaped their lives in profound ways. The Brewster Douglas demolition held special meaning for Brown because the complex shared a lot of traits with her childhood home, Herman Gardens, several miles away. As we drove along the edge of the now-empty, multi-acre lot, she pointed out her schools and the home her family was relocated to when Herman Gardens was demolished. These important spaces from Brown's life now stand vacant and deteriorating. These places influenced her choice to pursue architecture, not out of passion for the buildings, but for the countless, neglected residents that they represent. Many displaced residents, including Brown's grandmother, returned to live in a small cluster of new homes at the edge of the former Herman Garden site. From her front porch, we watch her grandchildren climb atop a playground while she recounts the city's promises of new economic development that never materialized. She can vividly recall the original community and each space where people gathered. Once the homes were destroyed, the local schools lost students and were closed. Businesses lost customers and ceased to exist. She can describe in detail which aspects of Herman Gardens' design worked and which didn't. Brewster Douglas was built for low-income African-American families. But who created the design? Who chose what to tear down and what to rebuild? What was their cultural agenda? Its construction and deconstruction happened without any meaningful inclusion of residents. This practice isn't isolated to architecture. It happens in many areas of design, including digital environments. When we break from the past, how we get to the next stage has an impact on who can move forward with that progress and who's left out. What does it take to shift long-standing cycles of exclusion? 400 Forward. From her years as a young resident in public housing to her career as an architectural designer, Brown has encountered many layers of designs that contribute to exclusion. And as she works toward her architecture license, there's one number she always keeps in mind, 400. In the history of the profession, just over 450 architects have been African-American women. In 2017, there were approximately 110,000 licensed architects in the United States. Just over 400 of these active practitioners, roughly 0.3%, are African-American women. The City College of New York conducted a comprehensive study of inclusion in architecture and concluded that the extremely low percentage of African-Americans in the profession, just 2% across genders, is the result of specific inequalities in the process of becoming an architect and the support received once new architects are in role. Improving inclusion in the profession, they state, requires deeper study of the considerations of how minority youth are socialized to think about the field of architecture and an understanding of the influence of social peer networks, family guidance, and educational awareness. The credential process is not the only way to describe the profession. There are countless African-American builders and architects who have shaped the American landscape. But credentialing matters, because critical decisions about the future of our cities are often made from positions of seniority and power. And these leadership positions are heavily gated by required credentials. Brown works with young people as a way to shift the future ranks of leadership. She co-founded the Urban Arts Collective, an organization that uses art, music, and interactive workshops to introduce minority students to architecture and design. Her most recent initiative, 400 Forward, is aimed at empowering the next 400 African-American female architects. Here's how she describes that journey. How did you choose architecture? Growing up in Detroit's inner city, we didn't have doctors, lawyers, and engineers running to our schools for career day. We had little access to the arts and zero exposure to architecture. Something like architecture surely felt out of reach for us. I was a student at what was considered a failing public school, and a college recruiter came to an assembly when I was in the 12th grade. That fall, I was studying architecture. It changed my life, and also changed my outlook on life. Returning to my old neighborhood to construct new housing was one of many full-circle moments for me. Many of my family members still live there, many of my friends. I've been asked if I would change the way I grew up. My answer is always no. It is a place where